You're listening to Scopes Monkey Choir. Music in a rational universe.
All, except perhaps teachers of music, will agree that at the present day, the piano is too much with us. It is one of the drawbacks of an advanced civilization, and if we are often tempted to pity those who lived in the dark ages before the dawn of the electric light, and when the automobile was not, our satisfaction at the superior graciousness of our state may be tempered by the recollection that they were free from the everlasting tinkle of the piano. The maelstroms of crashing sounds which many performers think it necessary to produce as proof of their skill jar the delicate apparatus of the nervous system to a degree that, in irritable persons, might have serious consequences if they were compelled to undergo the torture frequently. It was doubtless after an experience of that kind that Théophile Gautier defined music as the most costly of noises. Sir James Paget once took the trouble to calculate the number of muscular movements executed by a skilled player in a single performance. But who shall count the thrills, the pangs, the multitudinous shocks which a sensitive person suffers from the pyrotechnic display of a pianist who sets himself to tinkle the ears of the groundlings?
Tickle.
Grounding. Groundlings.
Tickle.
Oh dear!
Tickle the ears of the groundlings. Yeah. Tinkle the keys of the piano.
It's that last part is like J.R. Tolkien.
Tickle the ears of the groundlings. Precious.
I wonder if he hated the piano. Do you think we've given away our?
I think we've given away.
We've given away yeah. our this, instrument. Oh,
this
du
is
jour.
Scopes Monkey Choir, by the way.
Oh yeah, that's us.
Episode
number
23. I'm Matt.
And I'm Hiting.
And this week we're starting with the instrument du jour of the week, and it's the piano.
And that was not J.R.R. Tolkien.
No, it was not.
That was actually a writing from the British Medical Journal from 1899.
In 1899, this doctor was convinced that the piano was a scourge.
Scourge. And Théophile Gautier was that poet's name. But the title of this article that this British doctor wrote was "The Piano as a Cause of Neuroses."
Yeah.
And boy, has it caused some neuroses for me this week.
The piano?
Yeah.
It was a British Medical Journal.
Well.
Actually, I noticed, I found good old Google Books, you know, we got this quote from the British Medical Journal, a recent one. They reprinted it as like, hey, look what we were saying 100 years ago kind of thing. But I found the original one on Google Books. And in that same issue of the British Medical Journal, there's a little article about battling the anti-vaccination movement.
Oh.
So over 100 years ago, they were still
back
dealing.
Back then, they were battling the piano as a scourge of modern civilization, and now we're battling anti-vaxxers. It hardly seems comparable.
Yeah, well, both are still with us, anti-vaxxers and the piano, but I don't think anyone is ever arguing that...
Were there even anti-vaxxers in 1899?
There were, that's what I was saying. There was an article about the anti-vaccination movement in 1899.
Oh, not in 1999.
No, in 1899.
Wow.
And
ça change.
Yeah, but nevertheless, this guy in 1899, what did he say? Like that of 1,000 young girls who play the piano, over 600 of them end up with neuroses later in life or something.
Yes, anyway, afflicted with nervous troubles. If they started studying the piano under 12 years, and of the 1,000 girls who started studying the piano after they were 12 years old, only 200 of them were afflicted with nervous ailments. And of those who never studied the piano at all, only 100 were afflicted with nervous ailments.
Which is, so it just immediately brings up all sorts, 1899.
Wait, actually it says, of those who never touched the instrument at all.
Oh, yeah, because the piano is a virus from outer space, as we know. So the piano.
Yeah, the piano. The piano is amazing, and we could talk about it for many hours.
Yeah, we were thinking about calling this the piano part one, because there's basically no way we're going to get to it all. So we're just going to talk about the piano, and we're going to say whatever we feel like.
Okay. Piano. Let's start with, what is a piano today? It is a keyboard instrument with 88 keys, spanning normally A, 27.5 hertz, up to C,
4,000 something. I can't remember what. It was invented by Bartolomeo Cristofori. Is that how you say it?
Yeah, in about 1709. On
that
commission.
Was when it was first introduced.
Invented?
No, he started working on it in 1700.
Yeah, he was commissioned in 1700 by some duke who wanted a louder harpsichord or something.
Prince Ferdinando de Medici.
Oh, it was a Medici.
Yeah, it was a Medici. Same guy who supported Michelangelo, or same family anyway, I don't know, in Florence. So, yeah, 1709 is pretty early. It got attention right away. People found it fascinating.
Wait, let's talk about, just for a second, what came before that. It was basically a variation of the harpsichord, which was kind of a variation of the harp.
Yeah, we could also say it's a variation of the clavichord, too.
Right. Well, first there was the harp, first there was a harp, which was an instrument which had a number of strings, each of which had a different pitch.
Right.
Although, it's questionable whether the harp precedes the clavichord.
We're not doing harp.
Okay, so we talked about the clavichord in a previous episode.
Right.
That was where you have a keyboard, and on each key there's a... it's not a plectrum yet. It's a tangent.
Well, the difference is it strikes
a string and creates a bridge. It becomes a bridge. So it's actually shortening the string.
The two family trees that we're talking about here is plucking and striking.
Yes.
So with, for instance, a basic harp, you pluck it with your fingers.
Yes. The instrument before the harp was the psaltery.
Right, the psaltery.
Yeah.
And then, say, a dulcimer, like a hammered dulcimer, which is also quite early, you actually have a little light sort of hammer-like thing which you strike the string with.
Yeah, so, it was pretty much exactly the same thing as the psaltery. It was a box with some strings strung on it. And on the psaltery, you pluck the strings. On the dulcimer, you hit the strings with a little hammer.
Yeah, so good old Bartolomeo's innovation in inventing the piano was basically he took...
Wait, we didn't get through the harpsichord.
Well, but we can't do it all.
Well, you'd have to just explain that at some point, somebody attached a keyboard to one of these things, like a psaltery or a dulcimer, and made the key do something to the string instead of the finger.
Right. Oh, I see. So, yeah, why a harpsichord looks like a piano but is not.
And why you got from actually plucking the strings with or hitting them with your fingers or a hammer to transferring that action from a keyboard.
Right.
So you go through the clavichord, which we explained, and then you go into the harpsichord where the action on the string is plucking with what they call a plectrum, and which was made of sometimes... bits of crow feathers, quills, and stiff bits of leather, and they had this clever. If you think about it, if you have a lever attached to a key and you pluck a string with a little thing that's sticking out of that lever, if the quill goes by the string, it's gonna come back by, right? It's gonna go chink, chink. It's gonna go up and then down. So someone came up with a very clever spring kind of thing so that the quill could go up and then kind of spring away from the string and come back down without touching the string again, so you don't get a double sound. So that was the harpsichord. And then at some point, people wanted to make the harpsichord. Ferdinando de Medici wanted the harpsichord to be louder, basically.
And also to be able to affect the dynamics, because the harpsichord, you pluck it, because it's plucked, there's no way, it's always the same volume. Whereas the clavichord, which was just a household instrument, was not, because it was so quiet, you could actually play it a little bit quieter, a little bit louder, there's a dynamic there.
But you couldn't get it to be very loud, because once you hit the string with the key, there was a a thing touching the string. So you didn't get very much sound out of it. It was kind of dampened automatically by being played.
Right. So Bartolomeo...
Cristofori.
He invented the basic mechanism, which is well, much changed at this point, the basic mechanism of the piano.
And it was kind of like a hammer. It was much like the action of a hammer dulcimer. You were hitting the string with a hammer. But the thing about using a keyboard to hit a string is that if you press down a key that has a hammer on it, like the clavichord, once you push down the key, then the hammer is going to stay on the string if it's just a simple lever.
Right.
So Cristofori, but whereas with a dulcimer, you have those little flexible hammers that you're hitting the top of the string with and they kind of bounce off.
Right.
And that allows the string to resonate. So, or it allows the standing wave to get set up on the string and a resonance to be thrown off into the air.
Mm-hmm.
A sound, a pitch. There we go. A frequency. So,
music.
So here's what Cristofori did. He caused the key to kind of catapult a little hammer.
Right.
Up against the string and then bounce back.
So when you, on a piano, when you press the key, you are not actually directly affecting the hammer that's hitting the string. What you're actually doing is setting off what is essentially a little catapult that tosses the hammer up at the string.
Yeah. In modern pianos, it's much more complicated than that. But indeed, that was the basic.
This is the basic idea.
So you're sort of like hitting another lever with the lever of the key.
Right.
And the second lever has the hammer on it. So you're like hitting one lever into the hammer that hits the string and then bounces back immediately.
Right.
And one of the problems of this early piano was that the hammers weren't fast enough. So they were staying on the key so long. Sorry, they were staying on the
string
so long that they weren't getting that nice bunk, bung sound. They were going bunk.
Right.
A little bit.
So they were recognized as being interesting immediately, but they were so expensive, and the harpsichords at this point were so advanced that these original pianos, they weren't much louder than the harpsichord. So people could see that they were interesting, but they didn't like take off like wildfire. In fact, Bach is said to have not liked them. And it's not really until... I guess a good way to think of it is the piano really coming into its own is Mozart, when he was 21 years old in 1778, came across a piano and fell in love with it. It was first introduced to a piano, and from that point on, he played the piano exclusively. So I know, we have actually already complained about how everything comes back to Mozart. Oh, Mozart this, Mozart that. But it's a good gauge of, like, the young, brilliant Mozart comes across a piano and says, no more harpsichord for me. That can tell you that at that point, the piano was pretty advanced and had clear advantages over the harpsichord. Though I am a harpsichord fan myself. just in terms of volume and dynamic possibilities, it really outshone the harpsichord in those.
I would say probably that in our broad sweep of history, it seems like Beethoven did the most for bringing the piano into its own repertoire.
Right.
To really writing things for the piano that couldn't be done on any other instrument. And in fact, he had a famous piano maker built him his own piano because... he was apparently frustrated by the range of the piano. He wanted more,
right,
higher and lower notes on his piano, and he wanted it to be louder. And so someone happily built a piano for Beethoven.
I still have the frilly-haired, crazy Beethoven image in my head, and I can just hear him like playing a piano and just being like, more notes, louder, more notes, louder.
That's basically what happened.
Yeah.
Oh dear.
So, what are the things that changed in the piano between its introduction in 1709 and then its true rise to popularity by the turn of the next century? One is volume, and the volume was volume and tone. And these things are very affected by things like string tension and what is on the hammer that's hitting the string, and the length of the string, and there are a lot of elements that go into it. And so that whole sort of 70, 80 year period, people were refining the techniques of making the piano. The strings got longer and the tension wound, the tension got tighter. And then also the strings got larger. And then also they had multiple strings. Whereas on the on a lot of the other keyboard instruments, you just had one string, right?
Or, yes.
On the harpsichord, you could play two.
Sometimes there were two strings.
Certain settings.
Yeah, actually, there were quite a few.
But by the time the piano came on into its own, the low strings were one, a single wound string. And then above that, you had 12 or 18, somewhere in there, that were two strings playing the same note. But then the majority of the notes on the piano are still to this day three strings that are all tuned to the same note, and they all get hit by the same hammer.
There were a couple of important technological advances that caused people to be able to build pianos like that. When they were first made, they were like harpsichords entirely made of wood.
Right.
And so the frame on which the strings were strung was all wooden.
Right.
And they could only hold up to so much tension. A steel string has to be under a lot of tension in order to give a clear note and one in the range of the piano. So wooden frames would actually buckle. Wooden frames and the soundboard, which the strings are strung across.
Right.
And
you sort of imagine the inside of a piano. If you imagine taking the soundboard, which is essentially a piece of lighter, softer wood like spruce, I think they usually use now. Imagine a essentially flat piece of wood that's about the shape of the piano, and then take a harp and lie it down on top of that piece of wood, and then attach the harp to that piece of wood. Those are the essential elements in a piano that are actually making the sound. Like the body around the piano, it does affect the sound, of course, but the main thing is you have a harp lying down on a very resonant piece of wood, and that's what's making the majority of the sound.
And we talked a couple of weeks ago about stringed instruments and how the wooden part of the stringed instruments is what actually transfers the sound waves into the air and
right.
causes there to be enough sound for us to here, a little ways away, that the vibrations are passed from the string through the bridge to the body of the instrument. So in the piano, that soundboard is the body of the instrument. And the huge size of that wooden soundboard is one of the things that allows the piano to have such a big sound. As I said, the frame of the piano was wooden when it was first made, just like harpsichords.
Right.
And throughout the 19th century, the second half of the 18th and the beginning of the 19th century, people started adding metal braces
right.
to the frame so that they could have longer strings and string them more tautly.
Right. And
then finally, in the middle of the century, someone patented a cast iron frame. So,
and you knew who that was? That was Heinrich Steinway.
You know, it was not.
Oh, really?
No, I found some alternate histories.
On-air myth busting.
I know. I believe that it was patented a couple of decades before Steinway started using it, at least in England and possibly also in Vienna. At first, it was not very popular, a cast iron
mm-hmm.
plate for a piano, because maybe they didn't quite have it down. They didn't quite know how to pass the strings through holes in it properly, and it was incredibly heavy and all these things. But for whatever reason, it didn't catch on, and Steinway popularized it. But there were a lot of other piano makers using
it's good to know.
Metal frames.
Well, he was a German who went to the U.S. and settled in Queens.
First, he was Steinweg in Germany. Yeah.
Oh, Steinway, I see. Yeah.
He changed his name to Steinway.
So he settled in Queens, where the Steinway Piano Factory still is to this day.
He was already making pianos in Germany before that, too.
Well, I would figure, yeah, because he had to know how to make a piano, right?
Good point.
So in any case, maybe it wasn't, it actually sounds like it was not Steinway who invented the cast iron frame, but he popularized it with his Steinway pianos. And what this, now at the modern piano,
generally has about 226 individual strings. Remember that many of the strings are doubled or tripled up. Now, and they're very tightly, they're very tight. And in the end, what you end up with in the frame is about 51,980 pounds of tension. Now,
yikes,
that's a lot. 51,980. I mean, that weighs almost as much as me. Ha, 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 ha. Yeah, I'll take that out.
And it's almost as tense as me.
So that's a lot of tension, and that's why you need this this metal frame.
So those steel strings that are strung on the cast iron frame and have so much collective tension in them, a lot of them in the lower octaves have to be really thick because of physics. There's a whole formula about what thickness of strings need to be at what length in order to get a nice resonance for the particular pitches. And it just turns out that in the lower octaves of the piano, it helps to have a much thicker string, because mm-hmm. then you don't have to have like a mile long string in order to get the right pitch. Yeah. And so they increase the thickness by wrapping them in spiral coils of brass or copper, I think.
Yeah.
And even a simple steel string is not kind of an ideal string in the physics world, right? It doesn't set up a perfect standing wave that's exactly the length of the string.
Right. So as a quick reminder, there's the physics of the universe gives us the harmonic series, which is in a perfect tone has quieter tones that are sounded above it in a ratio that is just the way the universe is.
Check out our harmonic series.
Yes, exactly. Now, no instrument technically has the exact perfect harmonic series. There are variations, and which is one of the reasons why different instruments sound different. But the piano is actually quite a bit different.
It is, and partially because the steel itself is so stiff.
Right.
That the overtones, especially on those low strings where the string is really thick, each successive overtone, I think the idea is that instead of a wave that has a wavelength of half of the string, so there are two waves per string,
right.
or four, at each level there, you kind of lose a little bit of length,
right?
Because the string is so stiff.
Right.
And so the overtones are what turns out that makes the overtones a little bit sharp compared right. to the ideal.
And the higher the overtone, the sharper it is.
Right. So among other things, when you tune a piano, lots of tuners tune the low strings a little bit flat so that the harmonics that are in the standard, in about the middle of the piano range, sound, those harmonics that are sharp from the fundamental.
Right.
Sound a little more in tune to the middle of the piano.
So once again, we have an example of illusion.
Illusion. But
they cheat a little bit so that it sounds right. But if they actually tuned it exactly, it would sound out of tune.
Which means that if they do it with a machine these days and they just tune the fundamental, it will sound, might sound more out of tune.
Well, except if you're tuning a piano by machine, you're accounting for that because you're going to be tuning it to
maybe
how it sounds in tune.
But not necessarily if you're tuning it to a perfect hertz.
Oh, come on, though. But if someone's a piano tuner and they're using an electronic tuner, they're not going to get any work if they go in and tune a piano and it sounds wrong, right? Mm.
I don't actually know anything close to the answer about this, and I'm really curious about it. I'm really curious about it because I just learned as we were looking into this that they do that thing of tuning the lowest notes flat.
Yeah,
and they tune the highest notes sharp. This is leaving aside all the complicated stuff about tuning the intervals on the piano, and how if you tune them to the perfect series, then all the steps sound a little bit off. And
yeah,
that's
we're not
why
getting
they
into
get
that.
Into,
that's,
we'll
yeah,
do
that's,
a whole thing about yeah. about well-tempered tuning. But in any case... So the stiffness of the strings causes the harmonic series to be slightly sharp to itself. And here's another cool thing. The position of the hammers on the strings
right.
Has worked out. I don't know if somebody worked this out mathematically or if it was trial and error over the years, but they have come to be about 1/7 of the way down the length of the string.
Mm-hmm.
And this, because the hammer hits the string there, it slightly dampens the 7th overtone, the 7th harmonic, which is the most out of tune with the rest of the piano. Because the
seventh, it's the, that's seventh a really odd third that sounds odd third. Off?
Yeah,
oh, interesting.
Yeah. So that sort of minimizes that harmonic in the series and causes less chaos in the overtones of the overall piano.
Interesting. All right. Well, you know, since we're talking about the tuning, I was thinking it might be fun to talk about, because here's the thing, is that the piano is actually a really familiar instrument. So I thought it might be fun to talk about some of the different things that people have done with the piano in the past 50 or so years. And let's start.
Since it's no longer considered a possible cause of neuroses.
Right. Though, listen to this and you might feel differently.
Oh.
That is a microtonal piece by Ben Johnston.
Not Ben Johnson.
Not Ben Johnson. This is Johnston. Like Thompson and Thompson from Tintin.
Because Ben Johnson was mentioned in
right,
that
no,
article.
Right, no, I'm with you. Yeah. I'm with you. So that's, that's Ben Johnston, who's a composer. He's done a lot of different stuff, and he's done a lot of stuff with alternative tunings and such. He was a... I don't know if he was a student, but certainly a follower of Harry Partch. Anyway,
made
I just wanted to play that.
Made
because
a bunch of instruments of his own, created a bunch of instruments.
Harry Partch. And then I don't even want to get into it. It's an alternative tuning. It's basically, he uses a lot more notes than we use in our standard tuning. And I find that when you listen to this stuff, at first you want to vomit. But then you listen a little bit more, and you get used to it, and then you start to hear. It's like, and he's got something to say.
Did you know there was a period in the history of the piano, in the early history of the piano, where each black note was split in two, and that each half of it hit a different string. One was tuned to be, for instance, E flat, and the other was tuned to be D sharp.
Oh, account for... Oh,
but
interesting.
It did not achieve popularity because it was so difficult to play.
Yeah,
because
it's freaking annoying, yeah. So here's another example of 20th century messing around with the piano.
A bunch of children playing the piano at the same time, right?
Or
same
monkeys,
piano?
Maybe monkeys.
Monkeys.
If you put 1,000 monkeys into a room with 1,000 pianos, they'll do that probably immediately. No, I have to say I love that stuff. That's not my favorite piece,
what
but
is
that's
it?
Conlon Nancarrow.
Oh, Nancarrow.
Yeah. So Nancarrow is a 20th century composer who did all sorts of stuff, but at a certain point he said, you know what? Fuck it. I'm writing for the player piano, and that's all I'm going to do.
Oh, the player piano.
So he got himself a player piano, and he got a whole bunch of blank spools, which, you know, the player piano is done with spools, and you have holes in the spools, and that's how it tells it, the piano, what to play and what volume to play. And he just started punching
Inspired
homes.
By the Jacquard loom?
Yes, that's right. Please watch Connections by James Burke. And that's what he just did. He just started writing pieces for piano that would be completely unplayable by a human being. That tradition has actually continued to a certain extent. The disc clavier, which is now a piano that it's an actual physical piano But it reads MIDI files.
It's a digital player piano.
Exactly.
Basically.
It's a digital player piano.
It's a robot piano is what it is.
It is. And people are, composers such as Kyle Gann have continued doing this tradition of writing music for pianos that could not be played by a human being. I don't have any examples to play, but Kyle Gann wrote a lot of cool stuff. You should check it out. I'll put a link up. And prepared piano. We should talk about prepared piano.
Prepared piano.
Which was...
throw in a pot with lots of boiling water. Stir.
Add star anise. Basically, a prepared piano was... I don't know if... John Cage actually come up with the idea? Or is he just sort of...
I have no idea.
Oh, we're a skeptical podcast. We're supposed to...
I know, that's bad, right?
Oh, well. Anyway... He took a bunch of stuff. And he took like screws and pieces of leather and bits of various things and put them in the strings.
He just threw a bunch of shit in the piano.
Here's a little bit. Yeah, so that's a little bit from John Cage's Sonata 5 for prepared piano. And once again, that became another tradition. People prepared more pianos, prepared them in different ways, and still are.
I love how they call it prepared piano. I don't know why that's so funny. It's sort of like an unprepared piano.
Right,
it's like you forgot to clean
implying
it out.
That an unprepared, that a regular piano is unprepared.
No, I mean that the prepared piano is like an unprepared piano because you failed to clean it out before you played it.
Oh, I see. Yeah,
it's like right. All this junk in there. Little bits of paper and pencils and stuff that fell in there.
So, and then once again, people are still doing it. There's a modern composer who, it's not his real name, but he goes by name Hauschka. NPR listeners maybe have heard him. He prepares the piano with more modern techniques using some electronics and stuff. And it's just yet another piano path on the tree of piano.
Speaking of which, yet another historical tidbit. Mm. At some point in the 18th century, during the explosion of piano, somebody tried out a bowed piano where they had a little rotary bow on every single string, a continuous bow. That made me think of your dentist drill preparation for playing the electric guitar.
Patent pending.
Yeah, so somebody had a little. Rotary bow on the end of every hammer, and they would
that's
bow
very
with
cool
the strings
also
it,
didn't yeah. take off apparently
no
well speaking
I don't know
of,
how they were powered
yeah
at
I
that
wonder
point.
Speaking of the piano explosion, here's the sound of a piano being dropped from 100 feet.
Oh, that's so disappointing. I was expecting like in the cartoons where it goes
I know.
It didn't do anything.
I know.
It just smashed.
You wouldn't even guess it was a piano, right?
No.
Yeah, but still, it's sort of, you can use it in your mind's eye. You can imagine it.
I'm horrified. But you know what you should do is check out this art piece by Rebecca Horn that is or was in the Tate Modern.
Called we'll put up Concerto for Anarchy.
Is that what it was called?
Yeah.
Concerto
for
Anarchy?
I have
Anarchy?
Sound of it. I have sound of it. Hold on.
Oh, it's great. That's more like it.
Yeah, on that one you can really hear the strings reverberating and such. And then also, you can also check out the Mythbusters, who blew up a piano.
And burned up one.
Yeah, they burned up a piano. And there's no particular piano-y sound, but the visuals. I'll put a link to the... It's up on YouTube. And, helicopter. So, yeah, Mythbusters blew up a piano. And... I think that's pretty much all we have to say about the...
Only less irritating to the nerves are the ineffective strumming of the amateur and the damnable iterations of the learner.
Are you okay?
The piano has been the causa teterrima of quarrels that have sundered ancient friendships.
Oh.
It has disturbed the finer adjustments of the cerebral machinery in many literary and scientific workers, has driven studious men from their books to the bottle, and has stimulated peaceable citizens... stimulated peaceable citizens to the commission of violent assaults.
Wow. Is that how you feel, or...
It's published. It must be true.
It's in a peer-reviewed journal. It must be true.
What's in a peer-reviewed journal? It was.
I assume that's from the other, that 1899 thing?
It is, yes, yeah, yeah. Yes.
That's good stuff. So I guess we should play a little tidbit from next week's. I think we should start calling it the instrument du jour of the week.
Okay, all right. So the instrument du jour of the week for next week
is... That's all they get. Is that enough? Is that too much?
I couldn't hear it. What did it sound like?
All right, that's fine. Whatever. Oh, before we go, Nexus, next weekend. This weekend.
Nexus is
April 9th and 10th.
And I will be performing on April 10th at
performing. It sounds, 1:20 you're a presenter.
PM.
You are a presenter at Nexus.
I will be presenting my performance at Nexus.
Yeah.
And Matthew will be there, too. Presenting my performance at Nexus. Right, Northeast Conference on Science and Skepticism. Baruch College, April 9th and 10th with several...
There are still tickets
several
left.
...satellite events. There mm-hmm. are tickets left. Go to...
There are two
NexusCon.org. Mm-hmm. NECSSCON.
.org. Mm-hmm.
And there will be... The venue is quite a bit bigger than they've had before, so there will be tickets at the door available if you want to come in. George Robb will be playing on Saturday night.
Mm-hmm.
So all kinds of drinking all around it. See you there.
Thank you very much for listening to Scopes Monkey Choir.
Oh, yeah, this was Scopes Monkey Choir.
From scopesmonkeychoir.com. We are professional musicians, but amateur scientists. If you doubt something we've said, don't believe us, look it up yourself. Nevertheless, each episode's page at scopesmonkeychoir.com has references and citations.
We welcome your feedback.
Back feed.
Write to scopesmonkeychoir@gmail.com or leave a message on the monkey phone at 347-788-0330.
Thanks. Bye.